Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour. This is a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. We have a full crew here. It's me, Vincent Diamante, on this side of the ocean, and I think you are back from your East Coast travails, right, Mike?
I am indeed, back in sunny Southern California.
Was New York a swamp, as is usually the case on the East Coast in summer?
Yeah, it was a swamp. I always go through this thing where I romanticize my childhood summers and growing up in New York, and I forget about the existence of humidity. So I go back and I always have the same brutal re-encounter with the truth and stagger back to LA, appreciating the weather even more than usual.
Excellent. We appreciate your presence here, just as we appreciate Alex over there in beautiful, beautiful Europe, Sweden. How goes?
Hello, Vince. Hello, Mike. It's great to be back. Sorry I've missed the past few shows. It's been an extremely stressful, high-pressure 2 months, I suppose. Everything's ramping up towards something extremely big, which I will be able to talk about next show. So there you go. That is a reason to be looking out for our next podcast release. But yes, I'm sort of managing to get my head above the water finally. And yeah, it's wonderful to be back and ready to chat some fantastic, juicy game audio madness with you two lovely friends.
That's awesome. I really like having the whole crew together just talking about whatever in the world of game audio, game sound, game music. There's always a lot of fun stuff happening. And around this time, there's always something that someone's complaining about. I don't know if you remember, but last year, there was this big issue where Spitfire and other parties were part of the scoring competition that involved a clip from Westworld.
Was that 1 year ago, was it?
That was basically a year ago.
Wow.
People were so annoyed, frustrated, angry, whatever. I did not take part in that competition because, quite honestly, competitions are just not my style. Getting in a competition, I've got too much other stuff to deal with anyways. And honestly, I thought the winner did a pretty cool job. Should we be really talking about this still? Can you communicate yourself? Can you really convey yourself to people, to these judges? The winner did exactly that. So, okay, yeah, he deserved to win. Boom, end of story.
But Vince, yeah, there is one very relevant competition to our field, which really you have to participate in at least once in your career. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
What is that?
Well, it's free to enter. There is no prize. Well, I guess there is kind of a prize, but nobody cares about the prize. It's very nicely sort of demo scene influenced, which of course makes it completely legit and totally fantastic in my book. It's the KVR Forum One Synth Challenge competition.
Yeah, the One Synth Challenge, right?
Oh yeah. So for those who don't know, every month on kvraudio.com, which of course probably most listeners would know of as one of the sort of main forums, along with GearSpace, as it's now called, for audio hardware and software and music production. KVRAudio.com runs this competition called the One Synth Challenge. And basically, they take a freeware or open source software synthesizer. And the basic rules are you have to write an entire track of music using only that one synthesizer and only free or native plugins. So you are not allowed to crack into your sound toys or your fab filters or your waves or your plugin alliances or anything like that. It has to be all native plugins to your DAW or free open source freeware plugins. And basically that's kind of it. I think there's a few other rules, like you're not allowed to have any samples. You're not allowed to have any effects that drastically alter the sound of the synthesizer itself. So you can't have, like, you know, heavy duty phases or flanges or modulation effects or pitch shifting or anything like that, which will really drastically alter the sound of the synth. And it is such a fantastic competition because you get a huge gamut of different kind of styles and different approaches and different lengths of music and different genres and different characters of sound. It's just amazing. It's a whole lot of fun and it's very laid back and casual, and that, you know, everybody is very supportive and gives you a lot of good feedback and good, you know, supportive comments for what you do when you submit. And yeah, I'm happy to say that I haven't done one of these in quite a few years, actually, but the best I've actually managed to achieve each time, there's usually about 100, maybe around 80 to 100, or maybe less now, I'm not sure, participants. The best I managed to achieve was fifth. I'm pretty happy with fifth, actually.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, yeah, that was for a freeware FM synthesizer. And yeah, I was pretty happy with it. Anyway, all of this is to say that Vince, Mike, yes, Spitfire have their competitions, and competitions in general may not be your jam, but the One Synth Challenge, come on, guys, it's fantastic.
I like the sound of that because it gives you constraints. And I think competitions, which can be like open-ended opportunities to spend effort for no reward, can be kind of daunting for that reason. But if you have tight constraints, I think it can be fun. It just trims the search tree.
The cool thing about that competition is because the constraint itself is something technical, it means that because it's not an artistic constraint, it means that the spectrum of stuff that you get from an artistic point of view is massive. It's like you get some people doing, you know, electronica, techno, drum and bass on that side of the spectrum, all the way to the other side of the spectrum. You get some very abstract stuff, some sound design stuff. You get some musically traditional kind of things as well. It's a whole lot of fantastic fun. It's actually also very educational and kind of therapeutic in our profession, you know, where we have all of this luxury of choice. It's kind of therapeutic to say, okay, I have to make my entire piece of music using only stuff from this one synthesizer, which in many cases is extremely primitive and also sometimes quite buggy, which also adds to the fun of it because you're not allowed to, I think you can freeze your tracks, but you're not allowed to sample the soft synth and use those samples in your track. So sometimes it can be somewhat stressful. It's very demo scene, basically. And, you know, what could be more wholesome than the demo scene, right?
Really cool. I'm actually looking at the One Synth Challenge website. They're already at 150. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's really cool just looking at all the different synthesizers that they've used over the years. They're all free. Right now, they're using one called Tal Noisemaker, which
they're doing really cool.
So they
do
they change the synth each time?
Yeah, that's right. Some of them, some of them come back again. So Noisemaker, I think that's probably the third time that they've done Tal Noisemaker because it is a really good freeware subtractive synthesizer from Tal. It's probably the third time. So sometimes they come back, and also sometimes you get access to beta versions of synths that will later become commercial releases. If you wanted to get really, really critical of it, you could say that from an ethical point of view, maybe it's not that great, but in some, you get access to these early betas. And then, of course, from the plugin maker's point of view, it's fantastic to have your product out there being tested rigorously in production like that. I think that in that case, the prizes, which are usually worth money, they're like plugin libraries or licenses for plugins and stuff like that. In that case, you do win like a free license to the synth in the end if you do actually if you win the competition. I think when I did it, I got fifth and I won. I won a preset library for something. Anyway, it's great. Let's talk game audio, shall we?
Yeah.
Technically, we were.
Yeah, it's a big part of it. I'm also just realizing that's a great list just because of the fact that most of those are free synths. When people are asking around, oh, yeah, what's a cool thing to try that I haven't tried before? That is a great list to reference.
Yeah, free. It's quite incredible these days what you can get for free. You know, for people just starting out in game audio, you don't really need a very, very large budget in terms of software to you know, get going, basically, in writing a score or pulling together sound effects for some kind of implementation for an indie game or something like that. You don't really need a huge budget on the software side. Hardware, of course, is a bit of a different story.
Looking at all this stuff, it does make me realize it's been a while since I've actually purchased something new on the sound library front. I made a couple of big purchases last year, but otherwise, my sound template has actually been really stable. I haven't been looking at the new stuff, which there always is new stuff. You know, sales coming from CineSamples, new products from Spitfire. There's a lot of stuff that's out there. Is anyone paying attention to the new stuff that's out there or any particular new announcements coming out from these big companies?
Mike, have you been, I guess you've been a little bit too busy to be fiddling around with sales and changing your setup recently, right, Mike?
Well, I do keep an eye on the major sales just in case there's something I've wanted for a while that's suddenly comparatively affordable. But like a lot of people, I think I went on a bit of a self-indulgent soundware bender during the first year of the pandemic because it was a way to, it was a little bit of retail therapy. And I think I've backlashed against myself and I've not bought any sound libraries that I'm aware of this year so far. So, you know, keeping my eye on stuff, but yeah, I've got nothing to report.
I'm in the same boat here. But what about you, Alex? Do you have your eye on anything or?
Well, actually recently, Spitfire had I think it was something like a 40% off sale off of some of their big flagship products. Maybe it wasn't 40%, but it was a fairly substantial discount. So yes, I have a confession to make.
Oh.
Yeah. I did indeed actually make a rather expensive purchase from that Spitfire sale. I thought, okay, I'm going to get myself like a air quotes proper orchestral library. I say air quotes because I'm completely taking into consideration the two people that I'm talking to here who are masters of orchestral libraries. And for context, I don't actually own any orchestral library except for Project Sam's Orchestral Essentials, the first edition of that. And that is kind of like the orchestra in a patch solution where you basically lay out the entire orchestra on your piano keyboard and you can just go for it. Unless you're like me and you can't actually play piano very well, in which case you cannot just go for it, as I discovered over the years in trying to do anything with Orchestra Essentials. So I thought, okay, I'm going to get myself like a proper pro level. I can hear you guys both cringing. That's why I'm putting in these dramatic pauses. Orchestral library. So here's the thing. I went through and looked through the different offerings that Spitfire have, and they have a huge amount of offerings right across the gamut from, on the one side, the Orchestral Essentials style of sketch tools, I guess you might call them. Or I guess maybe you both might correct me there, but for I guess from my perspective, they seem like sketching tools because there's no, you don't really need any experience with classical orchestra instrumentation because everything is all orchestrated for you. You just put your fingers down on the keyboard and go for it. So on that side of the gamut, they have their products like the Albion series and the new one called Abbey Road One, I think it was called, something like that. Then on right on the other end of the spectrum, they've got this series called the BBC Symphony Orchestra series. And that is actually a product. It's quite interesting, actually. It comes in three different levels. There's a free one called Essentials or Elements or something like that. And that one lacks the round robins of the more improved versions, which means that it does tend to sound a little bit artificial, but perfectly fine if it's just sort of laying in the background of your track along with other stuff to fill up some space. Then they have this Core Edition, and then they have one called the Professional Edition. And basically the difference between Core and Professional is the amount of mic positions. So with the Core version, you just get the one mic position, and that's what you get. And then with the Professional Edition, there's something like eight mics in the room where they recorded it that you can mix between to basically get very, very authentic, different tones out of the overall orchestra sound. But the key difference with the BBC Symphony Orchestra series is that these are actually separate instrument patches. So it's all divided up by essentially by section, together with some solo, like the solo violin, as well as solo trumpet and solo. Anyway, yeah, a few of those other the leaders of the sections, basically. So, yeah, I bought this thinking, yeah, it's time to graduate from Orchestral Essentials and get something serious.
Okay. How long ago was this when you bought it?
It was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And yeah, so I haven't actually had time to do anything with it yet because I've been so busy. So it's kind of a bit
of an anticlimax to that story.
So sorry. But actually, the thing that I wanted to ask both of you about was, in general, if you've spent the better part of your career perfecting your ability to orchestrate and to arrange the instrumentation of an orchestra to achieve an artistic goal, how do you feel about these products like Albion or Orchestral Essentials, where the whole idea behind them is it's sort of what they call the democratization of orchestral music, because you don't really need to have experience in orchestration in order to make use of them. If you just want to make a simple, you know, air quotes, orchestral sounding score with some legato patch that you're basically playing on a keyboard like you're playing a synth pad, it's very easy. You can just go ahead and do that, and it sounds orchestral. But
ish.
I've always wondered, like, from the point of view of professionals such as both of you, who have this ongoing journey to learn and to master the art of orchestration, do you see those kinds of products as being, you know, not legit, or like, oh, that's just, you know, that's the amateur way to do it?
I mean, I think they're great products. First of all, I haven't used a bunch of those products. Like, I have quite a few Spitfire libraries, but I don't have Albion. But what I know of Albion and what other people have told me about Albion and the stuff that I've heard from it is quite good. It does sound really good to my ears, and I definitely trust these guys as composers when they say that it's a great library and it does some really cool stuff. The thing that I'm thinking about when I'm hearing you talk about this is, what exactly is my relationship with the orchestra? You know, for a lot of people, that relationship could be really vastly different from mine, even if they would consider themselves similarly to me, proficient or experienced orchestral music composer. You know, just because you know how to write for brass doesn't necessarily mean you know how to write for strings, because, you know, you're a composer that happens to be an experienced brass player. Just because you're an awesome string orchestrator and composer doesn't mean you know how to do anything with that percussion section or understand the ramifications of doing certain things with percussion, because just how outfitted is your percussion in terms of personnel and, you know, whatever they're able to cart around, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of different relationships that one can have with the orchestra. Similarly, there's actually a lot of people that are very, very good at ostensibly writing orchestral music, but they have a workflow which really consists of them being very good at writing piano sketches and thinking about what is going to be the overall sound. And they're just thinking about that melody and harmonic reduction. And they have a really solid workflow in place where they can throw things at orchestrators and arrangers in order to make things proper.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of part of Spitfire's marketing angle for things like Albion. They have a very interesting video that Christian Henson does. He's the CEO of Spitfire, I guess, but he has a very interesting video where he compares the Albion series to the BBC Symphony Orchestra series to this new Abbey Road 1 series that they have. And he basically mentions Albion as being a very, very useful. It's either a very efficient, very useful tool for getting a sound straight away and moving on, or it is a great sketch tool for experienced orchestrators who, who just need to work very, very fast. You don't have time to go and, you know, enter in every part individually. So it's a fantastic quick route to getting a feel, which then later on you can go through and break down and manually orchestrate if you have the experience and the know-how to do that.
I kind of want to do like a visual art analogy where in the world of 3D modeling, there are a lot of artists that get at their art in different ways. Some people think about their, if the end result is going to be, say, a 3D model that is implemented in a video game, some people would just start right away with, you know, modeling primitives, you know, doing basic Boolean operations, let's cut up some polys here and there. And then other people are working with things that are not polygon based. Things like ZBrush, where it looks like you are sculpting on the screen and you're working in that medium for a while before that ends up getting converted into polygons. I think that there are a lot of music composers that do the same thing. For me, I come from that world of I want to know exactly what violin one is doing, violin two is doing, viola is doing. And I'm thinking on that level, even as I am conceptualizing what the high level arc of the piece is going to be. And then there are other people that want to approach it from the eye level. And then later on, they'll get into the nitty gritty. I think that's one of the reasons why I've never really dealt with either the hybrid type orchestra libraries or the sketching type orchestra libraries, because I don't like going at the music from that direction. I always start on a relatively low level.
How about you, Mike? Do you own any of these sort of instant ramen style orchestral libraries, and how do you feel about them?
I have the original Symphobia, and I think as a side effect of buying certain libraries, you sometimes also get ensemble patches as well. I think that's true for Cinebrass and some Spitfire. I mean, if you buy Spitfire's traditional orchestra, you'll get all strings all the time patch. So some of these qualities appear in the more traditional sample libraries. But I think the original Symphobia is the only one I have that's a ensemble quick sketch library of the kind we're talking about. Mm.
Do you use it very much?
I use it much in the fashion that you described. Sometimes when I'm in a rush, I will use it for a quick sketch, just because it can alleviate some of the mechanics of figuring out doubling. If you've got, you know, strings and brass, and Project Sam is very good at giving you a slick sound right out of the box. Mm. So it also spares you some of the balancing and EQ, some of the finesse work that you don't want slowing down the creative process early on when you're just coming up with sketches. That said, I also have the same bias that Vince has, is that I really do like to orchestrate, when time permits, the old-fashioned way with pencil and paper, focusing on a visual and oral, I'll say image, even though it's not quite accurate, but a sensory representation of what it's like to be in a room, imagining the orchestra, and using that to influence my orchestration decisions, even if the end result is sampled rather than real. It's just more creative. There's just so much stuff that you're never going to be able to do without those, with those out-of-the-box libraries. So for detail or finesse, and sometimes just conceiving of a cue, I really lean towards doing it the old-fashioned slow way. But all that said, yes, in a pinch, if you're using orchestral textures that are very bread and butter, not very imaginative, but functional for the basic needs of media scoring, I think they can be useful.
Mm-hmm. So the last question that I want to ask on this topic is one that's probably, it's overthinking it for sure, but it would be interesting to hear your views. Do you think that these kinds of libraries and the popularity of them in any way threatens the traditional art form of orchestration? Because if you want to get a basic, convincing orchestral sound, you can do that without needing to know anything at all about traditional orchestration, or of even You don't even have to have had that much experience in listening to orchestral music in order to get that sound. Therefore, do you think that it is in any way a threat to the you know, that legacy art form of orchestration?
I don't know. My gut tells me that it's about as much a threat to music composers and orchestrators as clip art is to graphic designers.
Right.
And I mean, I say that saying, knowing that clip art is real. That is a legit industry space that has thrived over the last three decades. But, you know, graphic designers are still needed and still serve some very useful functions in, you know, doing things either for commercial purposes or artistic purposes or scientific purposes. There's a lot of things that graphic designers are really needed to do. You want proper data visualization at a scientific conference? Yeah, you go to a graphic designer. You don't rely on your library of clip art. Similarly, maybe the stuff that comes from hitting a chord with a couple of these patches and something like Abbey Road can do the trick in a pinch. But if you really want to go all out, or if you're doing something for, I don't know, a AAA video game or a really big blockbuster Hollywood film, that's not going to cut it.
Right. Yeah, I think my take on it is basically these days we're surrounded by so many of these sort of quick solutions, you know. And I guess you could argue that the synthesizer preset, like the patch that comes with any hardware or software synthesizer, that in itself is a similar kind of thing. You could say that, oh, everybody is just using the presets in these synths, therefore the art of sound synthesis and understanding how to create sound from a synthesizer is under threat because nobody knows that anymore because everybody's using the presets. And of course, that's not true. And it's the same thing with tools like, you know, these, the last few years, we've seen a lot of these, I wouldn't say instant mastering, that's simplifying it too much, but using artificial intelligence to assist the mastering process. So it's less about, you know, the experience of mastering and more about, oh, I'm making an R&B track, press the R&B button. Thank you. Now it's mastered. Those things, of course, all of these sort of instant solutions are in no way a threat to the actual art form, the original art form of these processes.
Vince, I can't believe you made an analogy to clip art and not library music, which seems like the most obvious.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is a very obvious one. Maybe because I was still stuck on that visual thing from the previous visual analogy, but that's okay. I know you've been really busy, Alex, but do you have any first impressions or any particular feelings playing with BBC at all? Or have you had just no time?
It's really fantastic. It's really fantastic. Like when you layer it all together, so if you've, you know, you load up, it doesn't use Kontakt, it uses their proprietary wrapper, and you load it up onto separate tracks with different instruments, and you just start keying in, you know, different parts and just sort of a casual playthrough. I feel incredibly intimidated by this massive cliff wall in front of me of the learning curve of like, okay, how do I get this kind of orchestral sound? So basically when the crutches are off, you can't just put your fingers down on a keyboard and play a chord. Now you've actually got to figure out, okay, I want this texture. How do I do that? So it's quite intimidating, quite scary actually, if you've never done it before, because I've never orchestrated before. And only in previous times that I've needed any orchestral music for the projects that I've worked on, I've always just asked Mike, so, which I will continue to do. So don't worry, Mike. But anyway,
thank goodness.
But yeah, just incredibly intimidating. It's like, wow, there's like, if I want to get a tender sound out of the orchestra, okay, how do I do that now? So one good thing is that like it definitely inspires me to go back to the orchestral music that I really love to listen to, and to take strong reference from them. Like, so how is Sibelius doing it? Or how is Rachmaninoff doing it? Or what does Grieg do here? Or like what's Strauss do? And, you know, like really it does encourage you to sort of go back to those pieces that previously you've listened to from an entirely subjective, emotional point of view, and sort of start to break them down from an objective, analytical point of view, and work out, okay, how are they? What instruments are playing there? How is he achieving that sound? So, I haven't had time to really crack into it just yet, but so far it sounds amazing, and the ability to have really fine control over every individual section inside the one product, inside the one ecosystem, I guess you could say, is equal parts inspiring and equal parts intimidating for somebody in my position.
The BBC, just to clarify, the BBC Orchestra has the low level granularity comparable to traditional sample libraries. It's not like the Symphobia model.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at this list of stuff right now. So just for violins one, you've got different legatos, portamento and slurred, long flautando, short spiccato, staccato, pizzicato. I wonder if staccatos are like, I want to say that in the pro version, you have like staccato versus staccatissimo, tremolos, trills.
There are a few more, I think, in the pro version.
Yeah, just a few more. But even in the core version, you got all these things. Soltasto, long and short harmonics, Bartok pits, long marcatos, solpont tremolo. Okay. It's... You know, that multiplied by all the individual sections, like from violins two all the way through, you know, that low tuba there. Hey, no euphoniums. Hey, come on. Give us a tenor tuba somewhere. It's not quite totally 100% robust, but honestly, it's amazing seeing that this level of granularity is available in something that is really pretty affordable. You know, it's not chump change, but, you know, under $500 is, it's amazing what you can get these days. No piano, though. So that offends me. Where's the piano?
What were you going to say there, Mike?
I wish I liked the sound of it more, because when it came out, I listened to the demos and I tried the freebie version, which had the opposite of its intended effect. And then I said, I specifically don't want this.
Yeah.
I find it a little bit, this is completely subjective, so I'm not dissing anyone who loves this library. To my ears, it's a little bit harsh, a little bit garish.
Right.
And I just sonically prefer their other libraries, which have a little more of a natural sound. This is a little too in my face, and I can't quite break it down spectrally the way that you can, Alex, with your amazing ear. But if I were to guess, it's a little maybe mid-range heavy for my taste.
Yeah, see, that's really interesting, because that's specifically the reason that so when I was like looking between, should I get the Albion one, which is more suited to me as a musician, because, you know, I've never orchestrated anything before. I'm thoroughly on the electronica side of the spectrum. And then the Abbey Road as well is sort of in the similar direction, but is much more expensive. And then in the middle, we have this BBC Symphony Orchestra. I listened to the three of them and demos of the three of them. And actually, ironically, I had the opposite reaction to you, Mike. I felt that the Albion and the Abbey Road ones sounded a bit hyped, sort of a bit kind of, yes, probably exactly that orchestra sound that you're used to hearing on, you know, movie soundtracks or game soundtracks, but a bit sort of scooped somehow. And whereas the BBC Symphony Orchestra, personally, I found it, actually, I felt it sort of breathed a bit more, and it in the mid-range, you're right, it is more, much more present in the mid-range, and a little bit shy on the bass and the treble side compared to Albion and Abbey Road. But to me, that I just felt that sounded much more organic and realistic. So yeah, it's interesting how, you know, this kind of subjective judgment can be so different.
I'll tell you one thing that I think I really like about it in terms of the interface, and correct me if I'm wrong. The impression I got is that you can load up the orchestra as you see fit and then change the mic selection for everyone at once. Is that correct?
In the professional level, yes. Not in the core version.
Oh, interesting. So the core version just gives you your basic mic position and that's it?
Exactly. So it's basically like a big tree mic, and then that's all you get. So that is one of the, that and the I think the round robin quantity is the same, but the, as Vince mentioned just now, there's a few more of the different there's a few more articulations with the pro version, but they're fairly esoteric. The core version just cuts down the mic position, so you really only just get one. You do have control over the reverb of the room, which is kind of useless, to be honest. Because the room that it's recorded in is fairly dry. It does have a nice room sound. And when you dial back the reverb on the core edition, it's essentially just shortening the echo tail as the notes cut off, which doesn't really simulate a dry orchestra sound very well at all, because obviously when you're playing a note, it's blooming as you're playing it, and the microphones will be picking that up. So just because you don't have a reverb tail doesn't mean that, you know, cutting off the reverb tail results in a dry sound. It just sort of sounds like, oh, the end got chopped off. So that aspect is kind of not great, but you know, when if you play with a full reverb on, it just sounds fantastic. And of course, that the room that they recorded it in is I can't remember the name of the studio, but the BBC Symphony Orchestra does all their recordings in there, so it's good. Well, I think so.
Here's a related question. This may be one of our classic spin-off topics, but since we've done that many times, I don't see any harm. It seems like if you look at what Spitfire's been doing, they seem to have a little bit of a short attention span and maybe a fixation with different recorded environments and paradigms, where they've been just releasing, they've been reinventing the wheel kind of repeatedly. Remember the Studio Strings, which seem to be their newest, latest, and greatest thing, and that product feels like it's a little bit orphaned now. There's a BBC, which they've kind of positioned as the grand start of a new era, and you know, we'd expect a second edition or expansion sets or something, or more articulations, because the arsenal being offered seems to be less sophisticated than their past libraries. But you know, now they're what was the other one, the Abbey Road selection, which I know is not exactly the same thing, but it seems like they're just reapproaching the basics from different angles. And I wonder if this is because of consumer purchasing behavior, that people want to buy the newest, latest, and greatest, and they're less interested in buying, hey, here are all those articulations that you might need sometime as an expansion to the thing you already have. Or, you know, we resampled these strings and we improved the legato, like working on finessing and making more mature and robust an existing library. So have you observed that here? What do you think about that trend?
I think in the, I'll defer to Vince on this because I know nothing about orchestral libraries in general, but from what I've observed, at least the research that I was doing when I made the choice to buy this one, was that in the video where Christian Henson compares Albion to BBC Symphony Orchestra to Abbey Road 1, he says that BBC Symphony Orchestra is kind of done. It's kind of wrapped up, and that it doesn't feel like there's going to be much more in that series. Whereas the Abbey Road series is something that is larger and ongoing in some capacity that they haven't really announced yet. I would have to imagine that when you've contracted an orchestra to record for you in a room, and you've done that, and you've got one product from it, and the session is over, I would have to imagine that if you suddenly decided, oh, well, let's actually replace the oboes and do them again, or let's add a few more articulations onto the French horns or whatever, I would have to imagine that that's going to be technically an extremely complicated endeavor to go back to the studio, get the musicians in, maybe one or two are different because they're sick or they're new players or whatever, the same microphone setups. I would imagine that it would be extremely hard to match it with what's there already. So perhaps one reason that they are just basically, you know, as you said, approaching the same thing just from different angles over and over again could be technical, because the complexities of sampling an orchestra are humongous, perhaps? I don't really know. What do you think, Vince?
I think there is something to that. I mean, what we have right now, or what used to be the backbone of Spitfire a few years back, was all this stuff from Spitfire Symphony and Spitfire Studio, where you had this anchor, this reliance on what was the space. You have Air Studios, you have that set up, and you are recording not just an instrument, but an instrument in this space. And I think that really compounded issues because I have heard and read on plenty of places and forums saying, when are we going to get a fix for this thing here? And someone will copy paste something that comes from a Spitfire representative that says, yes, this particular trombone thing, we'll try to fix that. That should be coming in an update pretty soon. And it inevitably doesn't. We're probably not going to be seeing anything from Spitfire Symphony or Spitfire Studio in a while. We did see an update last year, actually, which really wasn't an update. It wasn't new material. It was a repackaging of old material that comes from the old British modular library of sounds that they were selling not just a few years back, but a decade back. That was what their business was prior to them reaching out to the general consumer type of musician, which I would fall into. Before, they were making these really interesting big solutions for the AAA talent of the music production world. And that stuff is old. Now you can buy it, and it's cool that you can buy it. But there are still some issues here and there. I've personally encountered a couple things here and there. Stuff like, oh, wait, this particular string run doesn't sound quite right. Or this particular glissando effect actually is really not very well matched with everything else. It would be the type of thing that could be fixed in an update, or could be maybe fixed with some different contract programming. But again, even besides getting the space and getting people there, Spitfire themselves are kind of moving on from Kontakt. I want to put that in the rearview mirror. So easier to go forward than backward, I guess.
Mike, do you have any examples of other companies in the same sector who are approaching it the same kind of thing that Spitfire does, but with a different business model than the way that Spitfire is doing it?
Business model meaning the idea of relaunching new libraries that cover the same territory, or do you mean something else?
Yeah, precisely. So basically, you mentioned that Spitfire seemed to be approaching the same thing just from different angles. Like, have you seen examples of other companies who produce orchestral libraries approaching this, like, yes, you make one fantastic, great orchestra library. Well done. What do you do next? So Spitfire has their approach. Have you seen other interesting approaches or business models that other orchestral library vendors have taken?
East West did an update to their orchestral, like their 2011 orchestral library, which seemed like a legitimate expansion, which is kind of cool. I haven't actually tried it or used it, but that does seem to be a contrasting approach. On the other hand, Orchestral Tools, they're moving their Kontakt libraries to their new proprietary player. Sadly, they haven't done brass yet, which is the one thing of theirs I really own. They also seem to be launching some specialized libraries, which is, I think, another tack that Spitfire uses, these kind of boutique libraries. Bob's Medley's Hecklephone, better than any Hecklephone you've used, or different in some way. You've seen them, right? These sort of branded, super specialized boutique sample libraries that I think are just, a marketing-driven approach rather than a need of consumer-driven approach. And I presume that they work because new things still come out like that.
Yeah, it's really wacky. I just want to say the first thing that comes up when you click on products on Orchestral Tools website is Rimba. Tuned wooden percussion. And it's later on the page that you get more typical stuff like saxophones and Berlin strings and stuff like that. So they definitely are leading that way.
It's like an attempt to dizzy you with all these different specialized libraries. And I really think it's almost an attempt to disorient you and kind of make you constantly grab at cool things and not have a sense of what's the entire catalog here? Like, what actually matters? What's the meat of this catalog? And what are sort of these spin-off products that are just trying to create interest? I think the allure of specialized libraries is also it's less work, because I think it's very demanding to do to use the buzz phrase, deep sampled library, at least of something like an orchestra. If you're doing, let's play the violins on the G string, let's do it on, let's have them do half Ponticello, you know, like all these really esoteric or advanced approaches. I mean, it's just very demanding. Whereas I'm rambling a little bit, but the expanding of a thing is, I think, creates less of an impulse to buy than a new thing. So you see a lot of new things like Tom Holkenborg's percussion, which I'm sure is great, but what, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm a little skeptical. I'm totally spinning off on a rant, but I'm a little skeptical that there is a need for so much specialized timbres.
Metropolis Arc, that Metropolis series, I remember this actually, because I remember the design of the website. I have to say though, this library from the demos sounds fantastic.
Oh, Metropolis Arc was really cool when it came out. And I think it, my thought was that Metropolis Arc really did hit in a really cool place. It was very much a hybrid scoring type library that offered a lot of the various flavors of the full orchestra, not as robust as something like Orchestral Tools typical stuff or something like Spitfire Symphony, focused on people that want to do stuff mezzo forte to a fortissimo. That is a real need. I can definitely imagine being a composer that wants a really, really good thing that does that. But then they kept on going with Metropolis Arc. I think there's something like 4 or 5 different things in the Arc series. And each time they did a new one, it always felt like, okay, do I really need that? Right. It became harder and harder to imagine what the audience was for that. And nowadays, you don't see the big things coming out. Orchestral Tools now has their whole own ecosystem that is defined by their new player and being able to load, but more specifically, purchase all of these individual instruments, like this weird tuned wooden percussion. Or I'm looking at this thing called Amber that you can get. It's a string quartet where they recorded it tuned down a fourth. I mean, that's interesting. That is very cool. I'm sure there is someone that wants to buy that and play with that. I can't imagine that right now.
It may be sort of endemic of the situation that we are at the moment with audio production tools as a whole, not necessarily just orchestral libraries, because, you know, I follow the developments of software synthesizers because it's what I primarily use for my work. And it's like one after the other. It's like, come on, industry, how many emulations of a Juno 60 do we actually need? Or like a Mini Moog or a Roland Jupiter or a DX7 or, you know, or an Oberheim OBX or whatever. It's just like one after the again and again and again and more and more and more. And they all sound great. And I guess you could probably argue that the recent ones with the new super duper something or other proprietary, you know, simulated circuitry something techniques will sound better than the ones from like 10 years ago. Then again, you could also say that, well, once you've got it in a track and you've used one of your 13 vintage compressor emulation plugins to compress it and one of your 24 vintage EQ emulator plugins to equalize it, you would never guess that it was a 10-year-old software compared to something that was made yesterday. But it does seem like, you know, the idea, like what Spitfire is doing and what we've been discussing as well from Orchestral Tools is like, I wonder whether these vendors are, I wouldn't say running out of ideas or sort of getting desperate, but I wonder if we're sort of coming to a point where certain facets of tools that we use are kind of reaching a saturation point in terms of functionality and quality even.
I think it really is just a marketing saleable thing. It is a lot easier to sell something that is a unique instrument than, oh, hey, here is another orchestra, but the workflow is this, and that can be faster for certain people. You know, it's that requires a lot more time and communication nuance in order to convey properly versus, hey, here's a new instrument that you don't have yet. You know you want it. Let's complete your set.
Right. That's interesting, actually, because that's slightly different from what we see with software synthesizers at the moment. There aren't that many, you know, really groundbreaking, totally different, totally out there software synth releases generally. You know, if you look across the span of a year, there aren't really that many. There's sort of trends that go up and down. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it was subtractive synthesis. And then a little while, it was additive synthesis. And then the wavetable synths arrived about 5 years ago, I guess, and then everybody's into all the wavetable synths. And nowadays, you know, all of the sort of vintage emulation kind of stuff is sort of an undercurrent underneath all of that ongoing. It's yet another Juno emulation or whatever, the ones that I previously mentioned. It's slightly different because we're not really being offered new things as an entire, like, here's a new synthesis approach that you don't actually have represented in your collection. This is what you need. We don't really get so much of that on the soft synth side. So perhaps it's unfair to draw an analogy too closely between the orchestral sampling sector and the software synthesizer sector.
You know, attempting a philosophical full circle, you know, at the beginning we were talking about the one synth competition. And I wonder if there would be some value in trying to do a project. This is a little bit speculative, but doing a project and keeping to one library, if it's orchestral, then an orchestral library, if it's something electronic, doing something akin to the one synth library, not for the purpose of impressing anyone, but for streamlining your workflow, something like a palette, but limiting yourself to just one set of tools for workflow reasons rather than and deciding this is my artistic sonic palette. Maybe it's easier to say than do.
this BBC one that I've just bought. The Spitfire one that I've just bought. I wonder, though, because in the case of synthesizers, you know, because you're programming a synthesizer and you're using the workflow and the paradigm, the synthesis paradigm, to create something from scratch, there is really the capability to really learn one specific synthesizer and to get to the absolute bottom of it if you're only using that. And I find the two synthesizers that I use for the majority of the music that I do is one, they're both by Yuhi, and one is Zebra and the other one is Bazil. And I know those two synths inside out because I've used them so much. On the orchestral library, though, on that side, because you're dealing with a sampled orchestra, is there that much of a sort of, maybe this is a rather inflammatory question, but is there actually, like, if you said, okay, I'm going to do my next game score using only BBC Symphony Orchestra Core. If you said that, is there the extent of depth in learning that product as there is in the case of, say, a synthesizer where you're using all the functions of a synthesizer to create sound from scratch?
I think that there is definitely some virtuosity to build there. I don't own BBC Core, so I can't profess to how exactly that virtuosity curve would be. And it definitely varies from library to library. But I do think that there is a lot of time and practice that can be put into it in order to build up your virtuosity there.
Do you mean, for example, learning to say, oh, okay, the trills on the oboe, when they're at this velocity, they don't sound very good, so I'm going to have to avoid that. Is it that kind of thing that you would be learning?
I would hope in the opposite direction, less about the negative things. I know that when I mentioned some of these things in Spitfire Symphony that, there's maybe some problematic places, but there are actually also some really good things that are worth leaning into and things that actually take a while to discover. Stuff like if you use this this range of velocities for triggering portamentos with these particular notes, it really is particularly sweet. In much the same way that one might think, oh, that performer really hits that particular idiom of the oboe incredibly well, so I'm going to write to that, and I'm going to tell that player to accentuate that. And except in this case, you are the player because you are the one tracking and recording that MIDI data down. So you're really telling yourself, oh, this is something that I can do. You don't know that until you come across it. There's a lot of stuff in these libraries. When I think about something like BBC, it is more of a traditional library in that it is very much sample-based. There are a lot of other orchestral libraries that are more of a hybrid, where it either has some sort of proprietary technology going on because it's their own player, or even if you are using something like Kontakt, there's a lot of actual explicit synthesis that is happening that is used to glue together what is happening in the sample world. And here I'm alluding to things like sample modeling.
Mm.
And with that, there's a lot of control that you have, where it's not just CCs doing things like dynamics and filters and whatnot. It's things like, oh, if I do this, I'm going to, you know, do this particular effect that is the equivalent of biting down on this reed. And in addition to that, I can modulate that with this particular LFO that will do this particular effect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that there is actually a lot of space for growing with these orchestral libraries, some of them more than others. But it's, I would hope that, at least in your case with BBC Core, I'm pretty sure that there's some cool virtuosity to be had and built up there.
That's a really, from a philosophical point of view, that's fascinating what you said, the idea of writing to, like, for example, this particular articulation in this velocity range and this note range on this instrument in this library sounds particularly sweet, so I'm going to write to that. That is kind of, from a philosophical, musicological point of view, very interesting to me, because in the case of a software synthesizer, it's not necessarily emulating anything unless it's like a, you know, vintage emulation of something. But in the case of an orchestra, it's trying to sound like an actual acoustic orchestra. So if you're writing to a certain portion of an artificial sampled orchestral library because it sounds particularly a certain way, that's kind of crazy. Crazy in a amazing, inspirational, wonderful, interesting way, not crazy as in stupid, but like, because it's a simulated orchestra, you're writing to that. So if you have the opportunity to have your score performed by an actual orchestra, then the oboe player goes and plays that. It doesn't sound anything like what you were hearing when you played it with your orchestral library because it's an actual person. Then, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when it comes to these orchestral libraries, you know, there are people that are behind it. And sometimes these people are just really amazing. And depending on the library, they actually really are allowed to play the way that they want to.
Right.
I mean, sometimes this difference is really quite nuanced. And sometimes the difference is really stark. For example, on the old Miroslav Orchestra, you know, because of what Miroslav wanted in terms of the orchestra, and also because of the traditions that the players came from, the players were really allowed to do all these different things throughout their articulations. So Miroslav's really interesting because there are no loops. The modern versions of Miroslav, all your sustained notes are going to be looped. But back in the day, with the old Akai or whatever format you have, Roland, whatever, they were just longs. And with those longs, you really get each individual player articulating that note in their way. And their way is something that really moves through the note, regardless of velocity.
Mm.
And so strings will push through this note in a different way than a clarinet would, than a flute would, or than a French horn would. Mm. The horns are really interesting on Miroslav because it's not just that they push through the note at various velocities that you choose, but also the vibrato is there throughout the whole time. And that vibrato has a huge impact on the sound of the note at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end of these really long, long articulations. And it's quite a sound. And when I was playing through that, because I owned old copies of the Akai Miroslav, I converted it to V-Sampler before putting it into my Cakewalk projects back in the early 2000s. When I was playing with it, I couldn't help but think about this particular brand of musicality that was coming from this particular player that was playing this note in this way. You don't really get that as much these days. I think some people would say modern orchestral libraries have a certain consistency to them that they didn't have back in the 90s when that library was conceived. But I still think that there is some aspect to that where you do have to recognize that these libraries, strings, winds, brass, etc., they're played by players and they have things that they like doing, that they love doing, that come easy to them. And if you listen carefully, you might find that there is something that's worth leaning on.
That's fascinating. I'm going to have to go up a mountain and gradually process and unpack this as I meditate. So in the meantime, if I need orchestral stuff, I'll just call Mike.
Anyone else is encouraged to use that method as well.
Yeah. Who needs all these mic positions? We got the real mic position here.
Oh, there we go. I think we have to end on that bombshell.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was too much. Don't let me speak anymore. Well, I guess with that, it's time to end. This has been episode 209 of the Game Audio Hour. You can listen to us on the major podcast platforms. So go to Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts. You can check us out there. In addition to that, you can follow us and review us on those platforms. If you like us, please feel free to give us a positive review. We'll also do updates on when new episodes come out on our Twitter, at Game Audio Hour. And we hope you can follow us there. Until next time, goodbye.